Okay, today I'm in Kingston Lisle in Oxfordshire with Broadcaster of the Year, Luke Harvey.
Only for another month. That's the worrying thing now.
For people watching in 2000 and whatever, he might still be.
Look.
We don't want to date this interview. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to me, Luke. Well, we started with that. How did it feel?
Do you know what? I genuinely couldn't believe it. Dan Abraham, the photographer, phoned me up and he said, and actually, I saw him at Exeter Races and he said to me, "You still owe your subs for the HWPA." I said, "Oh, I don't know." But that's something. And then he said, "Well, you've been nominated for Broadcast of the Year." I said, here's the money straight away. And I couldn't believe it. This is how mad it is. I travelled up with my ex-wife on the train and a mate, and got up there, got to Paddington, went straight down the pub, had two Bloody Marys, got to the awards, had probably a good glug of wine as well. And then I just thought I had absolutely no chance up against Lydia Hislop, Ed Chamberlain and Ollie Bell. I just thought I was 25s and drifting. And I know when I won, I was literally speechless. I'm not sure beforehand that it really meant that much to me. I don't know, I never really gave it a second thought, to be honest. But to go and win it was a bit special. I was really emotional and did the typical me, got absolutely lashed afterwards and lost the trophy. And Rob Dakin there, who runs at the races, he found it in a pub I couldn't even remember being in. No, it was a great. It was a real honour to be voted for. And it's been nice. It's been fun.
And how did your peers and your workmates take that, your victory?
Everything I do is looked upon as being a bit of a joke, really. But no, I don't know. I suppose. But people like, I tell you, I was really, really touched. Alistair Down said to me, he said, "You know, I voted for you. I think you're an excellent broadcaster. You know, you're a joke, but you're a joke. You're a great broadcaster." And so, when someone like that says that, someone you've admired from a young age, it does mean something.
Now, it seems that, right, you've just got this award, but you've been actually broadcasting for over 20 years. And then going back, you were briefly at the same school as me for a little while. You left at 16, back in Devon, in Tivy. So where did you go from 16 and leaving school?
Well, just very quickly, I'm the eldest of seven children. So we went to, I ended up going to, I was at Tiverton Comprehensive, as you know, one of the roughest schools you'll ever go to. We had free school dinners, you know. I had a privileged upbringing, if you like, in the sense that I had ponies and what have you. But we didn't have, we had sort of, there were no luxuries whatsoever. We all had hand-me-down clothes, and I did, I was horse obsessed from when I was 5 or 6, and that's all I ever wanted to be, was be a jockey. And so I'm not thick, but I'm academically, I got one English grade 3 or whatever it was, O level. So I've got absolutely no qualifications whatsoever. So really, from when I was sort of 14 or 15, it was just a build up to when I could get away from the place and start in horse racing. I originally used to ride out for Jeff White, whose son Johnson is now assistant trainer to Philip Hobson, has been for donkey's years. And I wrote to a few different trainers, Fred Winter, Fort Warren, and Captain Forster. Captain Forster was the only one that returned my message. And I met him down in Devon because he used to go hunting down in Devon. And I met him down there. And yes, you've got the job and away to go. 16 years of age. I don't think I'd ever, I'm not sure, but I can't remember, ever spent one night away from home. And then I came up here. Sandy May, who's a very good jockey, rode in the charity race at Chepstow a couple of years ago. I used to ride for David Barrons. He drove me up here because he was wanting to be nosy because he used to work around here. And from there on, I was plonked into the hostel with 16 other lads. And I can tell you, I think I cried for the first month, I would say. I hated it. I didn't like the food. Mum said I wasn't allowed to come home for 6 weeks because I had to sort of bed in. And it was unbelievable. So in the hostel, I was looked upon as very privileged because I actually had my own room. I didn't have to go in the annex. We had four doors down from me. There was Michael Caulfield, who's now a very successful sports psychologist. On the opposite side of the corridor was Richard Westrop, who works for the BHA, is a stipendary steward. We had all sorts of different people drifting in and out, and it was, I honestly think, I had no mortgage, I didn't owe one pence to anybody. Those days at Captain Forster's were the happiest days of my life.
I suppose people watching this now would be quite surprised to know that Devon and the West Country wasn't a hotbed of jump racing than it is now. So you needed to move away to get on.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I mean, there was David Barron's down in Kingsbridge, he was doing well, and obviously Martin Pipe. But yeah, no, it wasn't, you know, as it is now. But when I came out here, you know, there were lots of different people. I went into the yard. Hugh Davis was a stable jockey. Tim Thompson-Jones was the assistant trainer. Richard Dunwoody was sort of the next was up the ladder, and I was sort of just starting at the bottom. Carl Llewellyn, a guy called Adrian Rolls, he's now assistant trainer to Graham Motion over in America. So there were lots of big characters there, and as I said, it was early mornings, late nights. It wasn't long. I didn't used to drink, hadn't had a drink. I never have smoked, but. You know, going there was a bit of an eye-opener. I turned up on Sunday lunchtime and the lads had all been down the yew tree and absolutely lashed. I was like, what's going on here? You know, but it wasn't long before I was about 10 times worse than them. So, you know, I soon got into the groove. But, you know, those were the days that gave me a work ethic, because however late you stayed out that night, even if you hadn't been to bed or whatever you'd done, you got up, you did your horses, you mucked out, and you rode out. You might have been in a bit of a mess doing it, but I whatever happened, and I've carried that all the way through. Whatever I do in life, I get up the next morning, and I'm sure, looking back on it, those days were the days that really brought it home to me.
Now, you said there were 16 lads there. That must have been pretty disappointing for a young fellow with no lasses.
Absolutely gutted. But the captain was very, very regimental. You know, he had no women in the yard. He was against that. Every single lad, you know, in that yard was either had a licence or was good enough to have a licence. You know, we had people like Michael Furlong, who came over from Ireland. There were just so many absolutely brilliant riders. And Martin Bose used to come in sometimes. So it was just a fantastic time. And I went from, you can tell what I'm like now, but I went from being really quiet, not saying much to anybody, to being so gobby. You know, one day the captain had a dinner party, and it was in March or something, and I was gobbing off so much that they stripped me off naked, tied me to a chair and put me in the middle of the road. And so all the captain's guests, you know, Lord Chelsea and what have you, they had to slow down and go round this. And I think it was Lady Chelsea, someone went up to captain and said, oh, we really won't. There's an old lady in a wheelchair in the road. It was cold, mind. It was cold. So, you know, they were great days. They really were.
So you started riding in point to points, if I'm right, in my research.
Yeah, I started riding in point to points. As I said, I started riding out for Jeff White Johnson's father down in Devon initially. Then when I came up here, actually, funny enough, just up the road from where I live, literally a mile up the road, Colin Nash used to farm. And so every amateur at Captain Forster's, you sort of inherited the job. So in front of me, you have Richard Dunwoody. His first ever winner was on a mare called Game Trust. He won a novice hunter chase at the Cheltenham Evening Meeting. And my second winner was on Game Trust at Lockinge Point to Point. So that's where I cut my teeth, you know, riding all sorts of, you know, around here. They had very good horses. My first ride under rules, you'll like this one, was at Fakenham. And the guy up the road, there was a choice between me and Richard Dunwoody, who was going to ride the horse. So he said, oh, we'll have you up schooling the horse. So anyway, he went up schooling. Believe it or not, the lunatic wanted me to ride it in front of Richard Dunwoody. So anyway, it runs at Fakenham, and I'm still in front four from home, but it was an ex-selling hurdler, and it was just standing off at its fences. Anyway, it crashed out four from home, and the horse was winded, and I was stuck underneath the horse. Anyway, the lovely St. John's ambulance lady came over to help me and undid my skull cap, wrenched my skull cap off. And with that, the horse thrashed out, kicked me in the back of the head and knocked me out. So I was absolutely fine before she helped me out. So I suppose I should have taken a hint then that my riding career was going to be up and down. But No, that's how I turned professional when I was about 18, I think.
So how many rides did you have in point to points before that?
Do you know, I don't know. I had my first ride was at Otter St Mary and the horse broke down. My second ride, these were the horses my dad had, or freebies or lame ones or what have you. My second ride was a horse called Native Trail at the old Bishop's Lee point to point. And he'd run two or three times and fallen twice with proper jockeys on. And then I rode him first time and finished second on him. And I literally thought I was going to be the next John Frankham, Lester Piggott, Richard Dunwoody rolled into one. I just thought I'd cracked it. I was brilliant. And then I fell off the next three times or what have you. So it's a really good grounding, something I'd recommend anyone does.
So you made the transition to professional jockey. Was that a bit of a struggle to begin with?
I had an awful lot of rides before I had any success, but I wasn't riding. I was just riding for connections that I had down in Devon. I had my first winner at Taunton on a horse called Bickley Bridge for John Roberts, 33-1 shot. And I'll never forget it. John was very good to me. I used to ride for John Baker and after that Rodney Baker. And a lot of the smaller trainers, they really sort of gave me a leg up and got me going. And it was after a while that the Captain Forster then started using me. And to be honest, it sounds ridiculous. It was all pretty straightforward, really. I did well in pointer points. I did well as a claimer. I can't remember what it was. It wasn't many winners that used to before you lost your claim. But, you know, within a very relative short space of time, I rode to Bernard Law to win at the Cheltenham Festival. So, you know, it was all pretty good.
And is the, hear about the camaraderie of the weighing room and all that sort of thing. Is that some sort of glossed over fairy tale thing, or is it actually what it's like? Or is there some sort of real people that get the needle with each other there?
Look, you hear people say, oh, I miss the press room and all the press room. It's great. Compared to the weighing room, it's rubbish because everyone backbiting and talking about each other. In the weighing room, you know, they're like-minded people. You've got to be happy-go-lucky. You've got to be brave. You've got to be ballsy to do the job that you do. Every single person got on, and if there were any arguments, you know, someone would just, you'd grab them by the throat or you'd have a fight and it'd be that. It'd be done. The weighing room was just, it's a pub without any beer. It's absolutely brilliant. I used to rip the jockeys to absolute shreds. I used to be changed next to Willie McFarland and Ian Lawrence. We all used to live next door to each other. Carla Whelan, who's like my best friend as well. It is so funny. We used to rip all the trainers to bits behind their backs. We'd go out laughing and joking. People say these days, oh, they look at, oh, Sensei goes through the form. I don't think we ever really looked, and there were no breathalyzers then, so we were hung over till about Wednesday. And then start drinking again on Friday. So it was just the happiest days you could ever have.
Who were the biggest characters, established jockeys, when you first stepped foot in the weighing room?
Well, very latterly, I rode when John Franklin just about giving up. I just started riding, and I had a winner at Toast. And I remember him coming up to me. He didn't know me. He just said, "Well done, boy." You know, and it meant so much. So, you know, there was, I mean, Richard Dunwoody, you know, that's a Richard Dunwoody, Adrian Maguire, you know, latterly, you know, Simon McNeil, Peter Hobbs, you know, all those sort of guys. And I used to go to a lot of the smaller tracks. So I used to go down to Plumpton, Chris Warren, Banger Warren, and I had a Ray Goldstein. There are just so many, you know, around Plumpton and Fontwell and those sort of courses. And you know, my beloved West Country. I remember one day, because I used to race on Boxing Day at Newton Abbot. I remember going down there, I had six rides. The first ride, as I'm getting on it, the horse is sort of walking forward, she sort of grabbed it and jagged it in the teeth. And as I'm getting on it, reared straight over and body slammed me in the paddock. And I lay for dead. And then some old boy came across with a rug and put it over my head. And my mum came, ducked under the rail and ran into the middle of the paddock. She thought I was dead, you know. And I thought, oh, Christ. And I'm so mean. I was going to get up because I had five more rides. I was riding there. Don't worry about that.
Right, Luke, you had that lucky escape with the brush with death at Christmas there. But you went on to some magnificent success to Bernard Lord, Cool Ground, a couple there. Can you talk us through a bit of your
highlights? Well, Taberna Lord was my breakthrough horse. I got him as a spare. Jim Wilson trained him. I got him as a spare on Boxing Day at Wincanton in one of the Coral qualifiers. I can't remember. He finished mid-division, didn't give me much of a feel. Bruce Dowling was riding all the horses at the time. And, yeah, he ran all right, you know. And next time he was going to run, Bruce couldn't ride him again. So I rode him and he ran at Chepstow. And Jim said to me, he's improved this horse, you know. He's come on for that. Anyway, he ran an absolute screamer, finished fourth or fifth. And I said to Jim, this will win wherever you go with him. He's like a different horse. So then he ran at Sandown. It's called the Tote Place Ball, something hurdle. And I've got a feeling, you'll have to check this out, but he was the first ever price-wise horse. And he had about 9-12 or something on his back. The world and his wife had seen this run at Chepstow. And I think it might these days have caught the steward's eye somewhat. He made quite significant late progress. Anyway, so the world and his wife was on him at Sandown. And I'll never forget the commentary, because when I came back and listened afterwards, Graham Goode was commentating. And I dropped him out last, and it was going, da-da-da, and to Bernalord still at the back. And then they went down the far side, and there was about, I don't know, four to jump. And it said, to Bernalord starts to make ground, about time too. And anyway, he swept through, and he absolutely bolted up. Then he went to Cheltenham for the final, at the festival, Coral Golden Hurdle final. And I just couldn't see him be beaten. I've never gone to a race where I couldn't have been more confident. There was never a moment during that whole race or in the build up to it that I thought he'd get beat. And I'd tell anyone that asked me at the races as well, if they saw what's the chance. So I think he's a good thing. Anyway, I was jumping the last. It's every young jockey's dream. You jump the last upside, the champion jockey Peter Scudamore sticks up. Mine goes when he wins two or three lengths. So, absolutely blessed. The other obviously the big horse for me was Cool Ground, who I got the ride on him because Reg Akerst, who I was riding for at the time, moved to Whitcombe down in Dorset, and the Peter Bolton, who owned Cool Ground, left it. That's a sort of incentive to go there. And Reg, as you know, trained good flat horses and a lot of two-mile hurdles and what have you. So we get there. Reg didn't have a clue about him. There was a weighing machine. And Reg couldn't work it. So we never weighed him when he ran first time at Haydock. It turns out that he was about 50 kilos overweight. And he still finished fourth. And then, again, building up to the Welsh National. Look, you always, as a jockey, whenever you're going in and out there, you always get punters come up to you. If they're nice and gracious, I always used to say, yeah, look, he's got, this, that and the other. You get some people who just come up to you and be rude, God, what's going to win now? Yeah, go, you're rubbish tips, what's going to win? So, those sort of people, you just, good luck. But anyway, so leading up to it, he only had 10 stone, mind, a subsequent Gold Cup winner. Leading up to that, again, it's just really, really straightforward. And those two, Tavernalord and Cool Ground, were my breakthrough horses. They just put you on the map.
You mentioned the commentary there. Are you aware of the commentary when you're riding? Can you hear it?
Not really. I mean, sometimes, if you notice now, a lot of the jockeys, because they didn't have them when I was riding, but you have the big screen, so a lot of the jockeys will look across at the big screen just to see how far. You can hear in the background, you can hear crowds shouting and get off, Harvey, you can hear, but you're not really, during the race, you can't.
So a lot of people sort of hear these stories. You say about the punter coming up. Was there ever a time when somebody came up to you and sort of advised you maybe you shouldn't try your best?
Oh, yeah, all the time. When I was riding for Reg Acre, someone phoned me and said, if you don't win on this horse, it'd be a lot more, it'd be a lot better to you than if you do win on the horse. And then he started getting a bit abusive. So I just straight away, I just got straight on the phone and phoned Reg Acres. Reg always used to say to me, he used to say, there's a lot better jockeys than Luke around, but there's none more honest. I'm not a reminiscer. My sort of mantra in life is keep going forward, keep looking ahead. But when you look back at some of the things that happened, it's just incredible. When, for instance, I used to ride Catabatic, got the, we used to, Sam McNeil, I rode him, Graham McCourt used to ride him, then I got the ride on him. Then I rode him and he ran really well in the Victor Chandler. Then I got injured, so Sam McNeil got the ride on him and won. So then the owner said, oh, you can ride them in on alternate races, which is, seems crazy now. Anyway, it was Simon McNeil's turn when he won the champion chase. And you look, I'm very, very friendly with Simon. So I was absolutely delighted for him. But in another way, you can totally understand, I was absolutely gutted. So anyway, he went up to, he went to the Ibex pub for a celebrational drink afterwards. And I thought, oh, I better go, I suppose. They didn't want to sort of any sour grapes. So I went up there and obviously absolutely lashed, fell off the back of the bar stool and cracked my head open at the back off the floor. Of course, I was riding the next day, so I had to then, I had a big cut in the head, sort of the back of my head. So my skull cap was sort of down over my eyes like that, but didn't stop me. But there were some wonderful stories.
Now, you were famously described as a brave man by John McCrutt. We'll talk about that little incident later. There must have been some quite terrifying times when you were riding. Any that stick into your mind?
Look, I was never, if you notice, I was never the bravest jockey. It was always a calculated risk with me. So when I went out there, I was fully aware that one in 10, one in 11 rides ends up on the deck. I was courageous without being stupid. You know, you see some jockeys, they see the red mist and go absolutely mad when they're in a race. But quite often, a lot of those jockeys don't ride out. A lot of the people I used to ride out with, or ride against, don't ever sit on a horse anymore. Carlo Ellen being a perfect point in case, he just doesn't ride out anymore. Whereas I'm slightly different. I've always loved horses, and so, you know, I enjoy riding them. You can see by the shape of me, I had my fair share of injuries. I broke my collarbone 7 times one summer. And so I had to have that removed. You know, I've dislocated my shoulder, just the same as all jockeys, you know, broke the ball off my end of my arm. It's just, there are lots of different things, but, you know, I wouldn't say, I'm not a brave man. I just, it's a bit like sort of, you know, when you're in the trenches, they say, come on, lads, we're going over the top. You don't actually think you're the one that's going to be shot. And so when you go out in a race, you just, you know, I didn't really ever think I was going to fall. And if I ever thought like that, I'd have given it up.
They mentioned horses being backed, etc. Was there ever a temptation when you were a jockey to have it on? I mean, did it used to go on with jockeys back in those days?
No, not really. I don't think it did. You know, I mean, look, if you've got sport and you've got gambling, or, you know, and where cash is involved, there will always, in whatever industry, it can be picking potatoes, high-flying business in London, horse racing, whatever you like. We've seen it, you know, throughout the ages. It has always happened, and it always will happen. But no, I don't think so. I don't think it was, you know, I've never one that was overtaken by punting. I was never one. I think you can get obsessed with it, and I never was. And I don't think it was much more of a cavalier attitude. The jockeys these days, it's just ridiculous how professional they are compared to how we were. Horses don't run any faster, but you know, life changes, doesn't it? And change is good.
Is punting something you're interested in now?
I have a bet, but it's not something that's ever. It doesn't really light my fire for various reasons. One, when I go to the races, when I do my homework, I have to talk about 100 horses. And if you're punting, you've got to be, you cannot do it half-heartedly. If someone said to me, I've heard that, you know, 3 horses are injured in a horse box on the way to the races, and it's a 4-horse race, so the other one's a certainty, I still wouldn't back the other horse. I would never, ever back a horse that someone else has told me. The only time I'd back a horse is if I go racing most days of my life, so if I see a horse that I like, if I see, you know, I never understand why people whinge about horses, that they see a horse that goes, oh, well, that's a real closer, or that was a real eye catcher, and they go mad on at the races. You'll get people emailing in, use it to your advantage. You know, why make a song and dance of it? Use it to your advantage
and then follow that horse's career. This it's easy. I can pick the paper up in the morning and see which horses are going to be backed, or you know, or who are going to be weak in the market, because you know the stables. You know, yeah, that's without any inside information. I don't know. I can just tell by a horse's profile.
Right. So when your career as a jockey ended, was there like a catalyst?
Did it start? Did it?
Was there a catalyst moment when you thought, right, I've had enough of this now?
Yeah, I was riding for Arthur Barrow, who trained. What's he trained the horse to win got the Gold Cup eventually, didn't it? When Tide Cottage failed the dope test. Anyway, I'll think of it in a minute. I was riding one for him, and it was an absolute lunatic at Hereford. And he came in, he ripped me to bits, said, your bottle's gone, you haven't given this a ride. And then I just thought, I've never answered trains back. I've always been looked at it as a business deal. I would say, thank you very much, sir, for riding the horse, you know, and shake the owner's hand and that. And then I just said to him, you're talking drivel, you know. And I just thought, I don't need to be treated like this. And from that moment on, my mind was set on trying to get into racing, you know, broadcasting, because, you know, I realised that was just the end of the road. So from then on, I rode for another 18 months. Mark Richards was myself for exactly the same. And I decided then that I would try and mix broadcasting and riding, and hope that I could get good enough to be, you know, broadcasting, that I could eventually perhaps even make a career of it.
So you were quite sensible then. You didn't suddenly say, oh, shove it, and just leave yourself out on a limb.
There were a few words exchanged with Arthur. I remember that. But it was a calculated risk that I took. I knew what I wanted to do, and it's a bit like riding. You know, people say, oh, this. You know, a lot of jockeys, a lot of sportsmen end up retiring feeling very unhappy. You know, they get depressed, they quite often go on the beard, lose their money, because they just don't feel satisfied with what they achieve. I cannot believe how well I did as a jockey. Like everyone, I wanted to be a champion jockey when I started. I soon realised that was never going to happen. But it, you know, when I was thinking about it, you're going from race course to race course, being paid good money, riding good horses with women. Well, women were a lot easier to get with a J badge in your car than they are with a press P. That is for sure. It's just, you know, going to pass. It was just living the dream, and I loved it.
Right, we'll go back to the women bit later on, Luke. But just briefly, then, anything you would have changed about your career as a jockey?
Absolutely nothing. There is nothing I would have changed about a jockey. The only thing I do like now is that the jockeys have coaches. Whereas we never did. You didn't. You know, obviously, you had the replays to look back on. But when I started riding really badly, I remember asking Carl, as I said, he was my best mate, yeah, what are you doing? What are you doing? What am I doing wrong? And so, you know, as any sportsman, you know, you see golfers changing their swings, you see snooker players changing their cues. So, you know, there's always a point in any sportsman's lifetime that things just go wrong, you lose it. And the way that they're coached now is absolutely fantastic.
Okay, Luke, so you've hung up your saddle, you've got rid of your J badge, which we'll talk about later on, and you become a member of the press. Now, I understand you were right in there at the beginning with the Racing Channel, people might remember.
Yeah, it's the Racing Channel. So I'll tell you now, I started off, a lot of people might think, because I'm so yappy and happy-go-lucky, though, you know, you'll be a natural broadcaster. But it didn't come naturally to me. Well, some people might say it's still not natural to me, but, you know, it didn't come naturally to me, and I had to really work at it, especially working on flat racing, which I hadn't been used to. And they used to have an early morning racing news programme. I think it was 7:30 till 8 that was on the Racing Channel and going out on Sky. So I presented that a few times. And George Irvin, who was the main boss at the time, said, Lukey, you're rubbish. He said, you look like a rabbit in the headlights. You've got one last chance, and then you're kicked off. Anyway, the night before, being professional, I went out in London there was a few of the jockeys were up in London. So I went out, and one of the jockeys turned up at the... So then I went home early-ish. And then one of the jockeys turned up at the studios because... he had lost his wallet or something. So he still had his black tie on. and had cuts up down his arm and what have you. And they let him in, so he was in the main gallery. So just as we're going on, so you imagine it, so this is my last chance in broadcasting. George Irving's there going 10, 9, 8, and all I can hear in the background is this jockey shout, "Don't mess it! Beep, beep, up, Lukey boy!" And so I'm like nervous as hell. Anyway, luckily for me, that half an hour racing news went well, and the rest, yeah, it's been unbelievable how well I've done, really.
Now, talk about what you've done. You intrigued me a bit earlier with the J badge. Now, you're telling me that jockeys have got their sort of tweed-clad equivalent of groupies?
They do seem to be. Well, perhaps it was just because I had hair. I don't know what it was, but I definitely seem to be a bit luckier with the fairer sex when I had breeches and boots as opposed to cords and a hoodie. But, it's a wonderful, wonderful lifestyle. It's slightly different to being a press man, that is for sure.
Now, being a bookmaker's video channel, this is 18s and over. You got any particular stories about getting too sordid?
Well, there are a number of decent stories. There's a particular lady that was, we were driving through Hungerford one day. And when I was an amateur, obviously I had no money, and Captain Forster didn't believe in giving, so I had to clip the horses for any money. So the minute I start getting paid, not only was I getting a wage in yard, but I was getting a few quid coming in. Anyway, so like anyone would, when you've got a few quid coming in, I went out and bought a red XR3i with a Starsky and Hutch style white stripe down the side of it. So we're going through the middle of Hungerford on the way to Wincanton, and there's this lady coming along the pavement, pushing a pushchair, and Carl Llewellyn wound the window down and said something not particularly polite to her. So we like wound the window up, like laughing, like giggling kids, sped off. Anyway, we only went 100 yards down the road before those traffic lights were red. Anyway, this particular woman came up and was banging on the window. We were just laughing, like giggling kids. Anyway, then my precious car, she put her hand in her handbag, got her keys out and went, all down the side of my brand new, my pride and joy. But that was quite a funny story. But no, with the women's side of it, bear in mind my marriage lasted about 10 months. It hasn't been particularly successful for me.
What has been successful has been your broadcasting career. So we now find you on, you know, national TV, ITV Racing. I mean, what do you love about your current lifestyle and job?
Well, I was lucky. As I said, I worked on the Racing Channel, and then another big turning point for me was I was sitting at an awards do, and the guy next to me was the producer on Radio 5 Live, and we said we need someone to do the early morning bulletins. So I agreed to do that, which meant I had to leave here at 3:30 every morning to get there to do a 5:30 bulletin and then work till 9:00. And then I used to drive on to the races. It was never going to last in the sense of, you know, I got to stage one day going to Leicester. I fell asleep at the traffic lights. You know, I was just absolutely exhausted. But working for 5 Live opened my eyes to a wider audience, and the fact that, yeah, racing jargon people just don't understand. So it taught me an awful lot about life, and I really enjoyed working with Nicky Campbell, and I realised how limited my vocabulary is and how sharp those real, you know, good journalists are. And so I worked for them, and then after that, you know, At the Races started, and I was working for them, and then I got the, you know, another big break really when ITV asked me to become part of the team. So it was I was down the road, sat in a pub garden having lunch, a couple of beers, and then I get a phone call off Richard Willoughby. "Do you fancy being part of the team?" And I was obviously absolutely delighted. They offered me 15 days a year with ITV. And then we did the practice day, and it went really well for me. And they came back and said, "We'd like to adjust your contract. We'll give you 50 days. So that was, you know, we hadn't even started. So yeah, and it was brilliant. Now, the other thing that was nice is that you'd think that at the races might be a bit sort of their noses put out of joint, but they seem genuinely pleased that you know, Chappers, me, and Weave and Fitzy were working for Terrestrial Television as well.
Yeah, and that's quite good that you didn't have to turn one in to do the other one.
No, I mean, at the races, or as Sky as it's going to be, has been a massive part of my life. And so, yeah, I mean, I won't pretend it's, you know, it's been easy to dovetail the two, but you know, I'm a better man when I'm working. I think I'm not great when I'm idle.
No, you're known as the happy chappy. You're always smiling. You're always joking, and I can vouch that even, you know, this normal life is exactly the same. Do you think you're a bit of an easy target sometimes for people with a chip on their shoulder? And do you think maybe getting at you on social media and stuff is a way of sort of trying to deflect from their own inadequacies?
Yeah, some people say this, but don't really mean it. It doesn't affect me in the slightest. I know when I was riding, when I'm broadcasting, I know when I've done a good interview, I've done a nice bit of telly, and I know when it hasn't been, you know. And when you're like me, you're so impromptu. I never plan things. It's just off the cuff, everything I do. And so sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. You know, people are perfectly entitled to their own opinion. You know, now I noticed some jockeys getting annoyed when they get abuse on Twitter. You know, if you want to use social media, you've got to accept that you're going to get abuse. You know, there are a certain amount of people that will like you, doesn't matter, as a person, let alone a broadcaster or a jockey. And there are a certain amount of people that won't like you. So everyone's entitled to their opinion.
Are there any people on the team that really can't take it?
Oh, I don't know. There's some people love it and some people... But if you want to use social media, you know, I can't remember, you know, this bullying of jockeys. You know, some things obviously, when they say things about your family, or, you know, that is awful, and it's above, you know. I would, when we're in at the races, Jason Weaver and I laugh when we do our Friday night program. The majority of emails we get are all fun, and could you say hello to so-and-so in the pub in County Meath or what have you, and it's all good, and some really interesting emails as well. And then you get some saying, I hope you have a car crash on the way home, or I hope that horse dies, you know, and you're thinking, what sort of person would, but you would be amazed how many of those you get.
Do you ever feel like reading about and naming and shaming these people?
Yeah, we don't. We get one guy that comes on Get In programme, literally it's the first email. This is drivel. I hate this programme. And he continues to email throughout the whole night. So he watches 4 hours of us two giggling like idiots. And look, everyone's entitled to opinion, and I don't have to agree with it. As long as it doesn't affect me, I promise you.
People sort of may not think about that, but 4 hours of live TV, that must be quite difficult, really, to keep it up for that time. Or do you find that it comes naturally?
Keeping anything up for 4 hours is hard. No, I don't. Look, you've gone through it, so it makes it sounds repetitive, but there's always certain flashpoints in everyone's life that you see as turning points. You know, I mentioned, you know, To Burn a Lord and Cool Ground, and I mentioned Radio 5. But then the next stage was the Get In programme, which, you know, started, you know, Rob Dakin and Paul Cooper, who was the producer then, is now the producer on ITV, started that. And it was just literally me and Jason Weaver sitting there having a laugh, looking on the bright side. People finish work on a Friday night. You know, the racing, Dundalk and Wolverhampton, it's not high class. You get some decent races at Dundalk sometimes, you know, on a Friday, but it's not high class. And, you know, you can say, why is that? You're trivialising everything. People have had a long, hard week. They just want to relax. And it's probably the one single programme that has been, you know, I wouldn't have got ITV if it wasn't for that. Jason probably wouldn't have either. So it took us to a different level. Yeah, and sometimes it's hard work being a clown for 4 hours. But yeah, okay, I've been practicing for 52 years. But no, it's been a massive help to my career.
Okay, Luke. Well, I'm pretty sure that this video is going to overtake it. But up until this point, the most famous bit of video.
I know what you're going to say.
You Barney Curley and John McCrick. Now, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I'll tell you the story. Right. So Barney, I can't even remember the name of the horse, but Barney had a horse running, and it was, I don't know, it was a 6-4 shot, something like that. And it drifted out to 3-4, 5-1, whatever. Runs, jumps off at the back, pulls up. McCrick is going absolutely crazy. So Barney's going in, the stewards have called him in. So Barney's going into the steward's room, and he obviously hears or sees on the television or says that Luke Harvey and John McCrick are ripping you to bits. So he comes out like an absolute bull in a china shop. So I'm facing, I've never, to this day, I'd never met Barney Curley. I didn't really know Barney Curley. So I'm standing there like this with the mic yakking away. And the producer, in my ear, the producer says, look out behind you. And Barney Curley is literally running at me, red faces. It was literally like being in a pub where you're attacked by a drunk, you know. And I just thought, my first thought was, I could feel my nose sort of crunching where he head-butted me, because I thought that's what's going to happen. Anyway, he went absolutely crazy, Barney. And for about the first minute, I was like, oh my God, I was terrified. And then, because of what I'd been taught, my broadcasting brain just got into gear, and I thought, you are part of television gold. And it was absolutely extraordinary. He ripped into McCrick, ripped into Chapman, ripped into me. The only stupid thing is, he called me an underachiever. I'm genuinely think I'm an overachiever. So I mean, but no, it was when you look back on it, it's absolutely extraordinary. And then we had to move on. I think we're going on to another race. Otherwise, it would have gone for even longer. But to this day, Barney's wife made him apologise the day afterwards. I bumped into him then once afterwards at Southall, and we had a conversation. It was obviously the fire paper was lit there, but the touch paper. But he seemed a very nice man, and to be honest, I've got a lot of respect for him. You know, from what he did in racing and how clever a man he is. But on that occasion, I was terrified.
There's a few people. How did he save John's bacon?
Well, that is an interesting one, isn't it? And one that John's never actually answered. But I don't know. He ripped into all of us. Chapman and McCrick got the most of it. But I don't know. But it's good, isn't it? And the other one is, if you look at the video again, you look in the background. It was at Folkestone. You can see Bob Cooper from out the race. He's sort of looking like this in the background, cackling away. But no, it's something people won't forget in a hurry, that's for sure.
One of my fondest ambitions is to get Barney where you are and ask him about it myself. But so far, he's proven to be elusive.
no surprises there.
So this morning, you've been riding out. Why on earth do you ride out? You're a made man now.
No, I'm made man. Look, I ride out, as I said before, some of my former Wayne roommates don't ride a horse anymore. I ride a horse every day of my life, which I have done for probably 45 years, I'd say. I've ridden a horse every day. I ride out in the summer when my pointer-pointers are out in the field. I ride out for Nicky Henderson. If I'm up at York, I ride out for Richard Fahey. I love it. Horses, you know, whichever sort of way, whether you're a flat racing man, jumping man, whether you like betting on a horse or you just like the horses, my overriding feeling about racing is I just love the horses. That's what I do it for. I just like the challenge of getting that horse to run faster than the others. If I had to do something, if I won the lottery tomorrow, I would train. That's what I am. I'm a frustrated trainer, but I haven't got the mental capacity. I drink enough to be a trainer. I sleep with my staff. It's absolutely, I'm ideal, aren't I? But I don't know if I could cope with it mentally. I really don't. I had this old horse called Nawau that I got off Peter Cundall. And I was so terrified all the time that things would go wrong with him. I'd be lying in bed, then I'd get up in the middle of the night and go and feel his legs. I was just absolutely desperate. Anyway, the day before, he ran in a few pointer points, didn't run very well. Then the day before, he was running in a handicap chase at Toaster. And I'd been to barbecue the night before, and I'd done about anything else. I couldn't remember that I owned a horse, let alone anything else. So I didn't even get him in out the field. So I left him out in the field, hadn't given him his proper food or what have you, dragged him in out the field the next morning, took him to Toaster, and he broke the track record. So it just shows you what it's like, but I'd love to train.
A point to pointing is something that is very close to your heart. You're still very much involved with it. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, pointing is absolutely brilliant. I've got one point to pointer this year. I had two last year. Unfortunately, my old horse got a leg, Cecil, but I've got one now, and he's lucky enough he won a bumper for Nicky Henderson. But I enjoy it because you have to have a hunter certificate. After that, you can do everything yourself. I like leading them up. I like putting the boots on. I like doing the noseband up, throat lash. I just want to, it's just something I'm passionate about doing. And it gives me a real insight then when I'm sat at home or sat at the races, you know, talking about other people's horses, it makes me feel good that I've experienced it myself. So when people say, you know, why did Bovidaire only won four times before he ran the champion? Why don't they give him a harder race? Well, you don't know how hard a particular horse is. You just never know. You saw recently with Duvan, we've seen it with Thistlecrack, all these horses. To keep a horse like a premiership footballer, to keep them operating at that highest level is very, very difficult. And through my point of pointing, it gives me a real insight into how difficult it is and how little I know.
Now, you were telling me earlier you've got a few stories that you want to relate, Dodger McCartney being one.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, bookmaking quite often, more so these days, is looked upon as a dirty profession, having a bet, you know, people, you know, wherever, you know, you've got to gamble responsibly, quite rightly so. But, you know, when I was growing up, you know, Dodger McCartney was a man. He was completely, you know, as from people looking in from the outside, you always imagine a gambler, you know, collar up, sort of being very, you know, very suspicious all the time. Dodger was a larger than life character. He was at every race meeting. He knew all the trainers. He knew all the jockeys. It was never shunned upon that if you spoke to him. And do you know what? He never ever, well, perhaps it was just me because I was such a bad judge, but he never ever asked me for a tip. You know, he just wanted to know how is the horse, you know. So he'd always make his own mind up. And that's very much the way I would approach, you know, gambling. Or if I had a trainer that I wanted, I would never ask the trainer because it's my judgment when I do something. Yeah, you know, that's why I would never phone a tipping line. Why would you do that? It's your judgment. What you'd ask the trainer is he fit? Is he as well as when he won three starts back or whatever? So you're helping, you build your information up. There's another man, Jack Lynn, who's actually local to me back in Devon, that I became friendly with just because he used to do all the point to points. He was always up at Bratton Down or Bishop's Lee or all these, or down at Umberley. You know, he was always around. And again, a very familiar man. But bookmakers these days, you know, they're not as hands on. You don't see, obviously, a lot of it's done online now. So it's not the relationship with the people involved in the racing is not quite as close as it used to be, I don't think.
So do you think that's how racing differs now from when you first became involved? Is it a lot more clinical?
It's just professional, isn't it? But everything in life's more professional, isn't it? I definitely think people want more out of racing than, you know, we want more out of life. We used to go to the pub and have chicken in a basket and a pint of Mankey ale. Now it's all gastro food and it's fantastic. And it's the same now, I think, at the races. People want more. They want more out of life than just seven horse races. You know, I know people whinge about the pop concerts and things, but it was great at Champions Day when they had a family enclosure explaining the pony club were there and it, you know, all these different things. I just think we want and need more out of life now.
Now, you've got a great presenting style. I'm sure it would lend itself to anything, but you're obviously totally in love with the game, racing. Can you imagine ever working outside the racing industry?
I'd quite like to. I think if you can interview someone, it doesn't really matter if you're talking about grapes, potatoes, horse racing, football, whatever, you know, that you're asking very similar questions. What happened? How did it happen? You know, why did it happen? That sort of thing. So it doesn't make any difference. I wouldn't mind. I mean, but why move from something I'm passionate about, horses and racing? So why would you change tack? But if the opportunity arose, I certainly wouldn't be turning it down, that's for sure.
I'm quite surprised.
You think you're dancing on ice, are you? that lasted about the same amount of time as my marriage, that did.
Oh dear, you throw me off. So you quite surprised me earlier when you said that you'd love to be a trainer. Mm. But I mean, you're a relatively young man. There's a lot of time left. Is it not something you think, right, I'm going to bloody do that because you've done everything else?
No, I don't think so. I enjoy doing it, but it's you know, racing's got very Premier League now. The bigger trainers are getting bigger. You know, the small trainers are okay, but the middle tier ones, they're all struggling. You know, the good thing is when I go out and do my job, I'll go and work for Atla Races, go and work for ITV. I bill them, I get paid at the end of the month. You know, as a trainer, sometimes your owners aren't paying you for 3 or 4 months. It's, you know, I haven't got any hair to pull out, but it's a frustrating job. You know, you're trying to do the right thing. People are criticising trainers for running horses in certain races, and you, perhaps the owner's got a box there and he wants to run his horse. It's his horse, he can do what he wants with it. So, you know, it's a really difficult profession. But yeah, I would love to do it. I'm obsessed with, you know, everything. If someone said to me, you know, if you put a banana in your horse's ear, it'll make it run faster, my horse would have a banana in its ear. But I try every single thing, you know. I just try anything. My benchmark is Nicky Henson. Whatever he does, when I ride out there, I feed exactly the same food as him, exactly the same hay. He steams his hay. I do that, and I try and copy what work he does as well. So, you know, if he's a champion trainer like him or John Gosden or something, and you didn't try and do what they do, you know, you're mad.
Okay, so what are your ambitions then? What are you looking forward to 10 years? What do you want to be doing?
I'd still like to be doing what I'm doing. I want to travel more. I love work. I'm sort of, you know, some horses that, you know, you've got to steady them all the time, put a cross noseband on because they're a bit keen. I'm like that. I like going to the races every day. I think, although it took me 4.5 hours to get back from Fakenham last night, it's probably the best small race course in the country. It's just absolutely brilliant. So I'd like to be doing what I'm doing now later on, but I'd like to go and see some of the wonders of the world. My next brother down, Oliver, he's chief feature writer for The Sun. So he goes abroad probably once a week, and he's been every single place you can imagine. Now I'd love to go. I've never been to America, I've been to Australia, I've never been to any of the fancy countries, or, you know, to see some of the exotic things. But that's what I'd quite like to do. But to be honest with you, when I go away, if I go anywhere, I miss home. I just, you know, I'm never happier than when I've got a saddle, bridle, and walking over to my horse. And I often say this to even the trainers. I was saying it to Oliver Sherrod the other morning. I was out on the gallops, and I'm just standing there, and you're looking around, you're thinking, I'm blessed here. The sun is shining. You're in the middle of Oxfordshire, on a race or sitting there with not a care in the world. I just, you know, you literally just think you're the luckiest man ever.
A lot of people like to swap with you. Lynn Carvey, thank you very much.
Look out for our regular money back offers, including Pipped at the Post on selected horse racing and Saved by the 90s for all Premier League and televised championship matches. BeGambleAware.org, over 18 only.